Welcome to the 10K Collective podcast. Listen, if you want hacks, my friend, I'm afraid you're in the wrong place. Our philosophy has grown out of the 10K Collective London Masterminds. Members, by the way, make between $500,000 and $7 million a year in e-commerce, most on Amazon. Many have doubled revenue in the last 12 to 18 months. If you're that kind of person, this podcast is made for you. We're not puritanical. We use hacks. We just don't think you should focus on them if you're building a real business. Instead, we focus on what's been proven to work in the group. Real brand building, clear strategic objectives, courageous long-term goals, and long-range thinking. If you like that focus, keep listening, and welcome to the 10K Collective. Hello, ladies and gentlemen. This is your host, Michael Veazey, on the 10K Collective podcast. I've 325 episodes of the amazing FBA podcast. I've got to remind myself, this is a brand new podcast geared only to the needs of advanced sellers, although those who are just still learning will learn a lot from us, I hope. Today, I'm delighted to welcome somebody on the very important topic of sourcing. Ash Monger is the founder and CEO of IMEX Sourcing, been working for and running IMEX for 10 years now. IMEX helps sellers to outsource the sourcing, QC, and logistics for China imports so that they can focus on scaling their businesses. So Ash has a huge amount of experience, a decade now, of sourcing in China. So Ash, warm welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me, Michael. It's really an honor to be on the show.
It's a pleasure to have you on. So we met in London when you were passing through between continents the other day. And obviously, there's so much that can be discussed in this area. But first, we have to get through the traditional podcast cliches because people need to know who's giving them advice or thoughts. So give us a bit of your background. What got you started in the whole area of physical products and sourcing?
Sure, absolutely. So I started importing from China when I was a student at a university in the UK. So I was bringing in products from both India and China. And this is when Amazon used to be a bookstore and eBay was the king. And so I was basically bringing in fashion jewelry and a lot of fashion accessories. And I had a wholesale e-commerce website. So I did that for about 4 or 5 years. You know, it paid the bills at university and it grew into a pretty sizable business. And eventually I thought, you know, China was where all the action was. It was always in the news. I have been speaking to suppliers for a while, so I thought I might as well go to the other side of the world. And that's when I decided to pack my bags and come to China, and I never went back. So been here ever since. And then after coming here, you know, the first year was just done researching the market, meeting suppliers, attending the Canton Fair a couple of times, and finally I decided to set up IMEX Sourcing. And we've been around for about 9 years now. About 5 years ago, when Amazon FBA really took off and a lot of courses came out, especially the Amazon Selling Machine, that's when our business focus really started to change towards e-commerce. And gradually, we positioned ourselves to be a supply chain management company only for e-commerce sellers. And since then, we've kind of developed that offering, and we have also developed an online dashboard that allows our clients to manage their product projects, the production, sourcing, and yeah, that's pretty much the gist of our business.
Excellent. So China's where the action is. I like the fact that you came from one continent and studied in another, and then just thought that's where the action is, and you went to yet another continent. So you're obviously a man prepared to follow his convictions literally all around the globe. So that's very impressive. So. Yeah, 9 years of the company, 10 years of being in China. So I guess you got some serious insight there. And interesting that you focus only on e-commerce. I guess you perceive that that's a big enough business in and of itself. So we'll talk more about that possibly in future episodes about the differences between e-commerce and other things. But let's get to the basics then. So again, I'm going to ask a lot of questions that a lot of people ask in every mastermind I'm ever in. But they're the questions that need answering, I think, because they're the constant questions. So first of all, China sourcing basics, then what do you think are the 2 to 3 most important things you think a serious Amazon seller or eBay or e-commerce seller needs to consider when they're sourcing from China? What are the raw basics?
I would say the most important thing is to know exactly what you want as an e-commerce seller. So a lot of e-commerce sellers, you know, they pick their products based on, you know, research tools out there like Jungle Scout and stuff. So it's you know, they don't always understand the product well. So once you have identified an opportunity, it's really important to understand the basics of that product. So you can do that by ordering a sample to your place and basically opening it up and checking out the components. You can do that by going to YouTube and watching videos in the production process for that product. But it's very important to know exactly the specs you want, because normally what happens in China is when you go to a supplier, they will quote you for the minimum possible spec, normally for a product that is non-compliant. And as you start being more specific about your requirements, normally the price starts to go up, because they know that they're competing with, like, you know, 1,000 other sellers on Alibaba. So they want to start low. So it's really important to know your product inside out, the specs. That's the first thing. The second thing that I would say is, if you're not investing in quality control at all, the least you can do is carry out an inspection. You know, it's a lot easier to fix issues while the goods are still in China. Once the goods are on board, normally the cost of being able to send the goods back or being able to replace, or the negotiating power that you have with suppliers, is significantly less. So an inspection is the least you can do to kind of avoid quality issues. And finally, you know, if you are a more serious seller and if you're investing serious amount of money, I would really do the due diligence on suppliers. So it kind of amazes me that a lot of people, they get their first quotes from the supplier, they get their samples and they place an order without actually doing any serious due diligence on suppliers. So, you know, looking at how long they've been in business, what kind of production capabilities they have. And I've actually, you know, as we have gained more experience as a company, we have shifted a lot of our focus on putting in very strong QC processes. I mean, I think we've kind of established our processes quite well, but our focus has shifted on supplier intelligence, because we've found that if we can get a lot of data on the suppliers, and now we're able to get pretty much, you know, access to even their financial numbers and stuff, and see which markets they're exporting to and what's their size and stuff, that allows us to find suppliers that are way more likely to deliver a quality product. And as a result of that, we have to spend less time, effort, and cost in the QC process. So, yeah, I think those would be my three main tips there.
Okay, great. Well, we're already getting into some detail here, because this goes well beyond the usual tips. So know what you want. This is a really critical question. A lot of people, I think, when they start a business, just in the most general sense, don't know what they want. They got a vague idea they want to make money, but that's kind of too general. And yeah, I like the idea of looking on YouTube for production processes for that product. It sounds really obvious. I'm ashamed to say I've never done that. So that's a very quick, easy tip. Carrying out inspection, absolutely. But the other thing is even more important, before you even get into inspecting something that's already been made, doing due diligence on a supplier. So obviously you've got some fantastic abilities to do supplier intelligence now, and I can see the value in that, especially anyone who's sourcing China for a while can see the value of getting true quality in a sea of mediocrity. Tell us a little bit, if you're not based in China, what are the best ways to do that for yourself, to try and get some due diligence done?
So, I mean, if you're doing it for yourself, there are ways. You know, we actually have a very simple ad hoc service, which is not really part of a whole supply chain service, which is called, you know, supplier background check or company verification service. And we have like a basic and advanced level service wherein we kind of do that research and hand it over to our clients, and then they can deal with the suppliers themselves. So that's one option. The other option is, there's a lot of ad hoc tools out there. For example, you know, there are websites where you can get access to customs data. So you can see which countries the supplier is kind of exporting to, you know, how many shipments they've done. So that kind of gives you an idea of this scale. Yeah, that's a couple of the things you could try.
Okay. And if you've got any things, is that sort of Import Genius, things like that?
Yeah, exactly. So those are, there's another one called Panjiva. So there's quite a few websites out there.
Import Genius and Panjiva. Okay. There's always going to be somebody writing down the numbers. Well, by the way, folks, if you're listening, we'll put somewhere in the podcast, we'll put the number of the podcast, and you'll be able to get show notes from that as well. So listen out for that, and then you can get some very detailed show notes that we'll be taking. Okay. So you can do a bit of it yourself using Panjiva or Import Genius. There's also your IMEX thing itself. Okay, it makes a lot of sense. So that's some basics. Now let's let's plunge into some of the main issues that I keep hearing come up again and again with my seller friends over the years, which is quality, speed, and the whole kind of question of trustworthiness, whatever that means. There's a lot of different areas there, but let's talk about quality first. The biggest issue for many Amazon retailers is variable or simply mediocre quality. So we've already touched on this, but what do you think the other things are that people can do from outside China to improve on those?
In terms of quality, I think, I like to kind of break it into different processes. So it's your supplier shortlisting process where you want to spend your time on due diligence and stuff. Then once you finalize your supplier, it's more about putting a solid QC process in place. So that starts with having a good contract that defines everything you've agreed in Chinese, if possible, because English contracts have less value in China, both as a legal tool and also as a negotiating tool. You want to put down every single thing that's been agreed, the names of components and stuff like that. Once you've done that, again, you want to have a really good QC checklist that would kind of act as the standard against which goods are checked. And finally, I think, one very common mistake I see people make is they would get a sample that would be 90% right, and then go back to a supplier, say, we love the sample, everything is good, but we would like this small thing changed. And the supplier would normally come back with, hey, not a worry, when we get into bulk production, we'll change this and we'll be all good. And when the bulk production comes out, that thing is not addressed, or the supplier hasn't been able to address it to a level that the client expected. So the key there is you have to approve the sample before you get into bulk production. And then your expectation from the supplier should be to deliver bulk production that matches that sample. So if there's anything you're not happy with, it's better to do another round of sampling and spend another 2-3 weeks. Then kind of just have a verbal agreement and get into production. Because a lot of the times that issue exists because the supplier might not have the production capability to address that issue. They might need a very specific machine, tooling, and maybe they're just not able to address that issue. So it's really important to approve the sample as you expect to see it before getting into production.
Yeah, that makes sense. I mean, it comes down to a lot of things in China, which is, I don't know, well, you can speak to this, but I get the feeling that there's a couple of cultural things. One is good enough for the Chinese suppliers, but it isn't for Amazon consumers. And the other thing is that they're not going to add extra expense or go to the trouble of creating a wonderful product unless you push them to do it, because they're so driven by price. Whereas we've got more of a concept of quality in our heads. Would you think that's a fair summary, or tell me a bit more about that?
No, absolutely. I think you've nailed it. Both those points are very valid. The first point, I think there's a deeper issue here in terms of the culture, because in China, people generally are very accommodating and, people don't complain about small issues here. Even you go to restaurants, you get poor service. If you are from the West, you would normally want to express your opinion about that service. In China, people are very flexible and they're very okay with that. So that's the first point. If you're 90% there, people are normally happy, and suppliers think that you're being too fussy if you want to go from 90 to 100. So that's one common challenge that we're constantly training our team to deal with, where suppliers come back to us and they think the client's being too fussy and unfair. The product is pretty good as it is. Whereas the second issue that you mentioned is more about conflict of interest. Suppliers, in most cases, are thinking short term, and they're primary objective is to maximize their margin. Whereas for a client, it's obviously, margin is a key objective, but it's also about getting a quality product out there, because consumers in the West have high expectations. Being very upfront with the supplier about the quality expectations, that's why it's very important to put this on paper, because, even with us, when we get samples in the office, we never approve them. I mean, we have a first round of approval, but the client has to approve them, because what is good quality is also a very subjective issue. What is good quality for one person could not be good quality for someone else. Or we are looking at the same sample, but what is a quality issue for me could be a non-issue for you, and vice versa. So it's really important that you approve a sample based on your standards.
Yeah, I think quality is subjective. I think you're right. And I think that it goes together with creating, I think, a strong brand. And what is it that your brand is really amazing at. For example, if you've got something that needs to look fantastic but is going to be worn for a season in the fashion industry, then what's quality is about appearance, I guess. Whereas if there's something very ugly but functional, like, I don't know, a doorstep to walk onto a car or something, to get up into a car or something, I guess then function is more important than beauty. So that those things are a bit subjective, aren't they? And I think that's the kind of decision that a wise retailer makes when they are considering where to spend money and also where to save money. Because as you said, margin's important. And I think that goes even deeper. I think, you know, if you really understand your customer, the end user, then you need to know what they think is quality. And then you need to engineer that into your product and push that back through the supply chain. So I think often the problem that people have is that they don't really know what their customers think of as quality. Therefore, they have no really valid way of defining quality. It's getting a bit deeper, really. But that's not just a sourcing issue. I think it's, as you said, it comes down to knowing what you want in a deep sense, really.
Yeah, and I think that's where, you know, bigger organizations have a bit of an advantage, where they can go out and do market research and really know what is great quality for customers. For Amazon sellers, if the product already exists in the market, they can look at reviews of the competitors and stuff and see areas where quality can be improved. But if it's a brand new product that doesn't exist on the platform, then it's very much subjective and, you know, based on what they think is good quality.
Yeah, the only thing I would say about that, I mean, I've got a client going through this, and by the way, he's not a sophisticated Amazon seller. He's brand new to the game, but he's simply, I'm not going to reveal for his sake what the product is, but he's in something in this sort of construction trade. He's got friends who do that, and he's got something that isn't working very well. It's got a 2.5 star average on Amazon, and yes, it's got rude reviews, but he's, on my suggestion, given them samples of that and asked them for very detailed feedback, and is working with an industrial designer to create a product. And we'll talk about that as well. Creating unique products, a whole different question, but he's trying to create a product that solves those problems. So although he doesn't have access to big market research, he does have access to end users, which could be yourself, right? So I always think there's something very important about some simple pragmatic testing of a product by people who are going to actually use it, that is always possible. You know, that we don't always have to make this a very complex process, right? If you're trying to use a stepladder and it breaks when you use it, then it's obviously not good quality. I mean, that's not a good example, because you wouldn't normally sell stepladders, but you know what I mean. If you've got a pen and the ink runs out, or it sort of runs out after 2 days, or it smudges, or it breaks and bursts on your pocket, that's the sort of thing you can find by using it, I guess.
No, absolutely. It makes complete sense. There's always ways to get feedback, and the more feedback you can get, the better your requirements spec would be, and then the supplier is actually in a better position to deliver what you want.
Exactly. I think that with a lot of things in life, when you're outsourcing things, and unless you have a factory in your garden, there's no way you're going to not outsource the manufacturing side of things. It's very easy to blame the person you're outsourcing to. And sure, they may be partly at fault, but I always think that it's a lack of clarity that from ourselves and a lack of management of disciplines that often creates the problem. That can be true with a photographer who produces random photos because we haven't given them a brief, a packaging designer that produces packaging that isn't suitable because we haven't thought it through, and so forth. But anyway, so I'm trying to turn things back on the seller here as much as I can, because that's where we have control, right? Blaming the rest of the universe is rather disempowering. So absolutely, what other things can we do as the seller then to increase consistent quality? You've talked about the basics at the beginning. How do we ensure that keeps going over the course of, say, several boatloads, container loads rather?
Yeah, I think it's about, also refining your process. So as you work with the factory and you get feedback on how they work and how they communicate, you have to constantly keep upgrading your process and your checklist. So this includes improving your QC checklists over time, improving your contracts as you get new feedback about issues, you know, setting better communication mechanisms. And then normally I find if you have really good process, you can go from 0 to 95% in the first order, and you can go from 95 to 100 in 3 orders at the most. And then after that, it's more about maintaining the quality standards. And this is where, you know, the complexity of the product comes in, because we've had some fairly complex products with a lot of components and moving parts. And we found that on the 7th order, the supplier just all of a sudden decided to change the component because the component supplier was out of stock, or they were able to get that component like a dollar cheaper. But what the supplier didn't realize was they were invalidating all the certifications for that product by doing that. because the certifications kind of lists out the components and stuff. So that's the ongoing QC, you know, ensuring that the suppliers are using the same components. And again, in terms of ongoing QC, the least you can do is continue doing the inspections. You know, that's one thing I've learned in China. We have suppliers we've done 70, 80 shipments with, and we still do a pre-shipment inspection on every single order.
Wow. Okay. Yeah, that ties in. That's a consistent theme for anyone who knows about sourcing from China. I remember speaking to Kevin King about two, 3 years ago now on the podcast and the amazing FBA podcast. And he said, never, ever, ever ship anything from China without inspecting it. So that ties in. I mean, that's, I guess what you're saying is they have a culture, which in a way, I think a lot of the supplier culture ironically ties in with the entrepreneurial culture that a lot of Amazon sellers who are small sellers trying to grow fast have, which is cutting corners is not a big deal. But the trouble is you're interacting with the West's safety certification and legal issues. So actually, in a sense, the problem is created by a mismatch between sellers and the suppliers. We're all quite pragmatic. We just want to get a product out there that the customers like, really, don't we? And is safe. But between that and the legal requirements of the West. So I guess let's talk about certification a bit, because that is an area that is obviously pretty vital and can get very technical. And I know that it's very product specific, right? So how long is a piece of string? But give us some basics or some examples of how to go about that if you're entering a new area.
So I think this is a really tricky one because certifications are, I mean, firstly, it's a very wide area because each product has its own compliance requirements. And you know, firstly, it varies by country and sometimes even by states within the country. And then there are product categories. And then depending on the components being used, there are requirements. And in reality, you know, it's very difficult for anyone to know everything about compliance. Even we, for example, when our clients come to us and they're like, can you ensure that this would be compliant to the US standards for this product? And normally we tell them that we can ensure it's compliant to the standards that you set for this product, but we don't know all the standards because that's something that a compliance professional would know. And that's a separate field altogether. There are people who spend their entire day reading the new regulations. And what makes it even more tricky is the regulations are changing and updating all the time. So there are people who are dedicating themselves to this. It's expensive. You know, when you're starting out, it can be difficult to hire them. But then still, there's a lot you can do in terms of one of the things that we have done is we actually have a very strong strategic partnership with TUV now, which is one of the top three testing labs in the world. So we are actually able to get a lot of compliance related info from them in terms of what certificates are needed for which market. Of course, you can go online and do your research. Again, it requires a lot of reading, you know, boring technical legal stuff. So a lot of people don't really enjoy that part of it, and they tend to kind of skim over it. But yeah, normally what I have found in terms of compliance is the larger the value of your shipments, the bigger the risk.
Yeah.
So when you're doing smaller shipments, you will normally get away with it because, you know, from the point of view of the customs and stuff, the recovery won't be significant enough. But as you start scaling up, we've seen with our own clients that you get inspected more or you get asked for certifications more. And at that point, you have to kind of professionalize the process and basically get professionals on board or avoid products that have very high compliance requirements.
Yeah.
Like baby products and stuff that comes in touch with your skin or anything that could cause a health risk.
Okay, so just a lot of people will be listening to this thinking, God, this sounds horrendous if they're just starting out or even people who've been around for a while. So just give me a bit of a list of things that are going to be more high compliance requirements. You mentioned baby products and anything that comes into contact with your skin. Any other things that occur to you?
So, yeah, those two plus you have, products with the potential to have chemicals in them. Products that are like food grade plastics, consumer electronics with large batteries, you know, like e-skateboards and stuff like that.
Yeah.
These products tend to be a little bit more sensitive in general.
That makes sense.
Anything that comes under the FDA in the US would be something you want to watch out for as well.
Yeah, so that's the Food and Drug Administration, right? Yeah, so thank you. That's a very sensible list. So I suppose you've got a few options, which is number one, especially for those who are new or who are more comfortable with marketing than with the sourcing side, which is a lot of people, right? Myself included. But first of all, avoid things like the ones you've just said. And again, we'll put the list in the show notes. We'll put that at the beginning and end of the podcast, folks, if you want to check this out, because there's a lot of detail in the realm of sourcing, right? The second thing is, if you're doing small shipments, you could get away with it. And the third thing is, big shipments, just don't risk it, and absolutely true. I mean, the sellers that I know, they're shipping by the container load. Every so often, they get it inspected, and they have to pay for the privilege as well if it's the US customs. So guess what? I don't see that being any less either with the trade wars potentially heating up, which we'll talk about at another point. But I'd agree that it's not worth the risk when you've got a big amount of stuff. But TUV sounds like it could be the answer. How do you guys collaborate with TUV if you have got something that requires some certification or compliance?
Sure. So before I get into that, I do want to correct myself. I wouldn't say that you will get away with it if it's a smaller shipment. You may get away with it.
Yeah, no, so that's, fair enough. Yeah. Okay, fair enough. Yeah, legal cover there. Yeah, that's true. I mean, nothing is guaranteed, obviously. And
You want to be as compliant as possible. And, you know, my suggestion would be to avoid those product categories if you're just starting out.
Yeah.
Because, you know, other than the legal risk of getting inspected and stuff, the reason why they have all these requirements is because there is a real risk to the end user. And that's a more serious issue. So you want to avoid that as much as possible.
Absolutely.
And you know, sometimes we feel that the compliance requirements are extremely high in certain markets like the US and UK, but the same products are being used in other markets with much lower requirements and people are doing fine. But the fact is, you know, it's very important to respect the local regulations and recognize that the regulations are based on certain risk assessments that they have carried out, and you want to avoid that risk as much as possible.
Absolutely. I mean, de-risking your business, and I think given that this is a podcast for people who are serious about building a proper business, that de-risking your business, I think, is an incredibly wide topic, which we talk about in the 10K Collective, a £1 million masterminds that I run with sellers that are doing anywhere between £500,000 and several million pounds a year in turnover, mostly on Amazon, sometimes in their own e-commerce stores as well. But I think that's a big, big topic. But de-risking your supply chain, I think, is extremely important, because if you have something valuable that's worth defending, that's worth, you know, serious money, and you're planning to sell it, then you really do not want to be giving yourself some massive Achilles heel. Whereas if something got inspected, your entire product chain would be pulled from the shelves and you get sued or worse. So I agree 100% that we need to become more professional about these things, and yeah, or avoid them. But the middle ground where we fudge it is probably not a wise place to live. So tell me more about this, the TUV, because obviously that is one of the solutions. What is TUV? You said it's one of the third biggest compliance or the top three compliance companies. How does that work?
So within the compliance fair, you have a compliance professional. They just specialize in basically helping you figure out what the compliance requirements are for any given product. You also have legal experts that are also compliance professional from a legal perspective, but these guys can also be people working at smaller testing labs. Then you have the testing labs themselves that have the equipment to test for all kinds of things, you know, certain chemicals, function tests of products and stuff. So TUV is one of those labs. They have labs all over the world. They're a German company, and basically they help in terms of testing. But they also have experts in different areas who can advise us in terms of what the compliance requirements are for any given product and market. Because we use them for a lot of the testing that we do, we've kind of developed this relationship where we have access to a lot of the knowledge that exists within the company and the experts. So we use that as a key resource in understanding the compliance requirements for products.
Excellent. Yeah, and TUV, okay, yeah, I lived in Germany for a couple of different years in my 20s, and so TUV is actually it's like an MOT in Britain, so it's actually, they are so widespread that they even test German cars, so yeah, it's a very, very internationally known and very long established company as well, isn't it? And when it comes to precision, yeah, we can't fault the Germans. I mean, they are the most precise people I've ever met in my life. So having lived out there, so I think that if you're going to trust the German to be precise, that they're going to do the job for you. But also, I think the other thing to bear in mind, again, before we move on from this topic, the last thing to say is it's obviously scary to people. It's obviously complex. But those are two great barriers to entry. If you're serious about building a defensible business, if everybody is, you know, doing ASM 15,000 or whatever it is that's come out recently, and all the podcasts, my own included Amazing FBA podcast for beginners, then it's a very good idea to have some barriers to entry, and very good compliance testing being needed is, I would argue, one of those. So if you're brave and professional combination, then I think this is potentially an opportunity, right? And I just think there's always an opportunity the other side of pain, because if everyone else is too afraid to do it or doesn't do it properly and you do, then you win.
Absolutely. And you know, there's two more points that I want to add there. Firstly, you know, Amazon, I think one of the big priorities going into the future would be enforcing these compliance standards. So more and more sellers we already seeing are being asked for these certifications. So it's not just something that is nice to have and would give you a competitive advantage. It could potentially become a major risk if you cannot produce a certification when requested, because your products could be delisted, and it could take some of these certifications could take months to get. So ideally you want to be prepared. The second thing I was going to say is there's a lot of small labs in China that also do testing, and they tend to be a lot cheaper than the international labs. However, the certifications are not always recognized in the US or UK. We have seen the HMRC in the UK, for example, rejecting certifications issued by Chinese labs because they just didn't recognize the lab. So that's something to be careful of. A lot of people, when they go to suppliers produce these certificates given by small Chinese labs. And in most cases, firstly, the labs would not be recognized. And in most cases, those products are not compliant either, because you can get a certificate with a compliant product and still produce a non-compliant product in mass production. So having a certificate and ensuring that your product is actually compliant are also two different challenges altogether.
Thank you. So yeah, I like what you're saying as well. So you a bit of a reality check there, that this is not just a nice to have thing, but it's actually a must have. Although I would still argue if, for example, there are, I suppose, three options. Number one is you're an amateur supplier of baby products with no certification. You get asked for your certification by Amazon. It's not acceptable and they delist you. Option two is you stay away from baby products because you're scared. And option three is you do it professionally and properly and stay ahead of the competition. So I still think, in a sense, it's a competitive advantage. But I take your point that it's also, if you don't have certification, folks, on one of those types of products, food grade plastics, chemicals, baby products, anything that comes in contact with skin, food grade plastics, that's very common. A lot of people sell things like that. Consumer electronics, large batteries, that's less common. Then you probably want to be looking in certification quite soon, or possibly considering moving out of the product if the numbers no longer work. So thank you. That's a bit of a sobering but important reality check there.
Thanks for listening to the 10K Collective podcast. I really hope you found the show helpful. I mentioned the London-based masterminds we've been running since September 2017. Members of the 10K Collective Mastermind make a minimum of about £480,000 a year, well over 600,000 euros or dollars. To find out more about that mastermind, go to amazingfba.com/10KC, K for kilo, C for Charlie. £1 million mastermind members make a minimum of £1.2 million a year. That's about $1.5 million US or euros. To find out more about that mastermind, go to amazingfba.com/MPM. That's M for mother, P for Peter, M for mother. Thanks for listening.